Today is Saturday, January 31st, and this is the World Socialist Website.
Chancellor Merz demands German imperialism must learn to speak the language of power politics. The first month of 2026 has witnessed the explosion of American imperialism. It began with the Trump administration's invasion of Venezuela and abduction of President Nicolas Maduro, continued with bitter Trump's demand to own Greenland and control its natural resources and Arctic shipping routes, and is now culminating in the mobilization of an American armada of warships in the Middle East poised to strike Iran. The extent of the brutality and criminality of American imperialism with Trump at its head often obscures the aggressive intent of the European imperialist powers, or fuels the misguided belief that Germany, France, and Britain, the old colonial powers, are more humanitarian than their transatlantic rival. The remarks this week by German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, which in content were redolent of Nazi Führer Adolf Hitler, should put paid to any such illusions. Addressing the German parliament, Merz placed his remarks in the context of a new era of great power rivalry. For several weeks now, we have been seeing more and more clearly that a world of great powers is beginning to emerge. A harsh wind is blowing in this world, and we will feel it for the foreseeable future, he declared. This rhetoric serves to enforce the officially proclaimed new epoch in foreign policy, which has seen all parties in parliament unite to spend $1 trillion on preparing for war and impose social spending cuts to pay for it. Merz's response to the new world situation he described could just as well have come from one of Hitler's programmatic speeches in the early 1930s. We will only be able to implement our ideas in the world, at least in part, if we ourselves learn to speak the language of power politics, if we ourselves become a European power, he told the deputies. What he means is nothing less than the transformation of Europe into an independent military superpower under German leadership. Merz continued, firstly, we must take our security into our own hands. This requires measures to reduce dependencies. It requires us to invest heavily in our own European defense capabilities. The invocation of sovereignty and independence is the ideological cover for a historic rearmament offensive, whose scale is comparable only to German militarization prior to the two world wars. Together with the majority of this House, we decided last year to increase our national defense spending to up to 5% of gross domestic product, Merz boasted. In absolute terms, this means a German war budget of well over $200 billion annually, more than is spent on education, health, and social benefits combined. Merz explicitly presented this path as a model. We have led the way, and others in Europe have followed us. This rearmament is inextricably linked to comprehensive social spending cuts. The attacks on jobs, wages, pensions, and public services not only serve to directly finance the military, but are also intended to make German and European capitalism competitive on the global stage. Secondly, we must make our economy competitive again, Merz stated openly, referring to the growing growth gap with the U.S. and China. According to the Chancellor, Germany's ability to shape world politics depends, above all, on economic power. That is, on the ability to increase profits and open up markets and raw materials, including by military means. What Merz and the ruling class have in mind is an authoritarian, fortress Europe, akin to the dictatorship Trump is seeking to establish in the U.S., that enforces its imperialist interests worldwide under German leadership. Thirdly, we must stand united in Europe on these issues, Merz demanded, stating bluntly, unity is a factor of power in the world. What he means is the united enforcement of European imperialist interests with economic and military coercion against Russia and China, but increasingly also against the United States. As examples of European power, Merz cited the leading role of Europeans in NATO's war against Russia and Ukraine, and the joint action against the punitive tariffs U.S. President Trump threatened to impose on the European powers who resisted his push to seize Greenland. Anyone who believes they can make policy against Europe with tariffs must know that we are ready and able to defend ourselves against them, the Chancellor declared. At the same time, he emphasized that We do not want to recklessly jeopardize established alliances. As long as Europe needs time for massive rearmament and, above all, continues to depend on Washington's support in NATO's war offensive against Russia, Merz is keen to avoid an open confrontation with the U.S. This tactical restraint does not alter the fact that German imperialism is ever more explicitly striving for an independent role as a world power. The current global realignment also presents an opportunity for all players who prefer rules to arbitrariness and who see more advantages in free and fair trade than in the unilateral pursuit of their own interests, Merz explained. He described Germany as part of a dynamic, agile network of sovereign states, and in this context, praised in particular the European Union's planned trade agreements with India and the Latin American Mercosur states. Merz's attempt to portray his bid for world power as a defense of a rules-based international order is particularly cynical. In reality, Germany and Europe have supported every war of aggression led by the United States over the past three decades, from Kosovo to Afghanistan and Iraq to Libya. Merz himself boasted in his speech that German soldiers had fought alongside our American partners in Afghanistan after 11 September 2001 and declared that he would not allow this mission to be disparaged. The German government continues to support U.S. operations and wars that violate international law as long as they serve its own interests. At the beginning of the year, Merz openly backed U.S. aggression against Venezuela, supports preparations for war against Iran, and defends Israel's genocide of the Palestinians in Gaza. Against this backdrop, the official Holocaust memorial ceremony in the Bundestag the day before Merz's speech was pure hypocrisy. With its ritualized never again, the ruling class is trying to conceal that it is doing exactly the same again. Great power politics, militarism, and genocide abroad, and authoritarian politics at home. Significantly, Merz did not say a word about the openly fascist developments in the U.S., where Trump's ICE militias hunt migrants and murder counter-demonstrators in cold blood. The reason is obvious. Militarism abroad and authoritarian rule at home are also the program of the German bourgeoisie. Merz's statements on European nuclear weapons show how far advanced this development already is. Just hours after his speech, the chancellor confirmed during a press conference with Lithuanian Prime Minister Inga Ruginienė that strategic talks on European nuclear weapons are being held. These talks are in their infancy, he said, but we know that we have to make some decisions here, both strategically and in terms of military policy. Brigadier General Frank Pieper, Director of Strategy at the German Armed Forces Command and Staff College, goes even further. In an interview with Stern magazine, he called for Germany to have its own nuclear weapons and for politicians to make a real change. Germany needs its own tactical nuclear weapons, he demanded, adding provocatively, "Get out of bed and get to work." The demand for a German nuclear bomb is not only illegal, it would be a step that brings humanity even closer to the brink of a nuclear world war. This madness is supported not only by Merz's right-wing Christian Democratic Union, the Social Democrats, and far-right Alternative for Germany, but also by parties that claim to be left-wing or progressive. Representatives of the Left Party and the Greens, who already approved the government's horrendous war credits in the spring, attacked Merz not because of his war policy, but because, in their view, he was not aggressive enough towards the U.S. and Russia. The Left Party's parliamentary group leader, Søren Pellmann, called on the federal government to now draw conclusions. This applies both to economic policy and security policy. He then exclaimed, "Where is the export ban on German weapons to the U.S.? Stop kowtowing. Take action." The Green Party warmongers are particularly impatient with the pace of preparations for war against Russia. Referring to the government's stated goal of being ready for war against Russia by 2029, the Green Party security policy spokesperson, Sara Nanni, ranted hysterically. "We have 35 months left. 35 months. 35 months to go until 2029. I ask you, what are you doing until then? What is being arranged? When will the Shadow Fleet be stopped? When will the Taurus missiles be delivered to Ukraine? When will investments be made in comprehensive defense, and when will the population be prepared for the possibility of an emergency?" The madness of war has objective causes that the Trotskyist movement has long analyzed, As early as 2014, the Socialist Equality Party, SGP, examined in a resolution the historical and political forces behind the war policies of all capitalist parties and warned of the consequences of the return of German militarism. History is returning with a vengeance. Almost 70 years after the crimes of the Nazis and its defeat in World War II, the German ruling class is once again adopting the imperialist great power politics of the Kaiser's Empire and Hitler. The propaganda of the post-war era that Germany had learnt from the terrible crimes of the Nazis had arrived at the West, had embraced a peaceful foreign policy, and had developed into a stable democracy is exposed as lies. German imperialism is once again showing its real colors as it emerged historically, with all of its aggressiveness at home and abroad. But the same contradictions of the capitalist system that are driving society inexorably toward war, the contradiction between the global economy and the nation-state system, and between the social character of production and its private appropriation, also create the objective basis for social revolution. In the United States, resistance to Trump's fascist policies is growing, with workers and young people protesting against ICE murders, going on strike, and discussing the preparation of a general strike. Workers and young people in Germany and Europe must orient themselves towards this powerful social force, the international working class. The answer to Trump's policy of might makes right is not the German or European language of power politics, but the international mobilization of the working class against all imperialist warmongers. The only progressive perspective lies in the overthrow of the capitalist system and the building of an international socialist society. The Socialist Equality Party and its sister parties in the International Committee of the Fourth International are fighting for this program.
We have it in our power to begin the world over again. 250 years since the publication of Tom Paine's Common Sense by Tom Ackerman. Few revolutionary tracts match in importance Tom Paine's Common Sense. Published for the first time on January 9, 1776, 250 years ago this month, the pamphlet, A Frontal Assault on the Entire Aristocratic World, is widely credited with clearing the way for the Declaration of Independence, which was ratified just 6 months later. The anniversary arrives under conditions that make Paine's assault on monarchy newly relevant. Donald Trump's unconcealed attraction to the prerogatives of absolute rule and his contempt for the Constitution are not just his own pathologies. He is the chosen leader of a staggeringly wealthy oligarchy and the product of a diseased political order increasingly divorced from popular life, conditions that echo, albeit in modern form, the world Paine confronted. At the same time, mass opposition, expressed in the No Kings demonstrations, and the eruption of protest following murderous state violence in Minneapolis has again raised fundamental questions of sovereignty, equality, and the right of the people to resist arbitrary power. Common Sense speaks to this moment. Also, much like the present, in its own time, Common Sense addressed a conjuncture in which the central issues had not yet been widely grasped. Until its publication, the public debate about the imperial crisis between Great Britain and its rebellious North American colonies had revolved around whether Parliament had lived up to its ancient duties under the British Constitution, not whether or not the existing order, as in fact Constitution was then understood, was itself to blame. The debate was motivated by colonists' desire to return to an imagined status quo ante before the ever greater assertion of the empire's authority in the years following the Stamp Act of 1765. This took the form of polemics over Parliament's right to tax the colonists, who were not directly represented in that body. Despite its legalistic appearance, it would be a mistake to treat this as merely conservative debate. For beneath the controversy over taxation and representation lay revolutionary stakes, questions of power, liberty, and above all, equality. Through 1775, most colonists could not face up to the explosive implications of the positions they advanced, a weakness their loyalist opponents exploited. The Tories leaned on the great English jurist William Blackstone, who argued that in every government there must be a single final authority and, quote, absolute despotic power, end quote, as he put it, that has the last word. In the British Empire, that power lay with the King in Parliament, the King, Lords, and Commons acting together as one sovereign body. To question any part of that body was to challenge the whole. From this widely accepted premise flowed a direct challenge to the colonial position. If Parliament, the very body that, quote-unquote, constituted the realm, would not rule the colonies, where then would sovereignty reside? Paine had an answer. Quote, but where, say some, is the King of America? I'll tell you, friend, he reigns above and doth not make havoc of mankind like the royal brute of Britain. In America, the law is king. End quote. Here, Paine predicted what has been called, quote, the American theory of government, end quote, at least before its complete inversion by the Trump administration. The people, not the monarch, would be sovereign. Paine used a metaphor to describe this transformation in sovereignty from king to citizen, urging that the crown itself be, quote, demolished and scattered among the people whose right it is, end quote. By the time Paine wrote these lines, the constitutional crisis had already slid into war. The Crown had placed Boston under martial law, declared the colonies in open rebellion, and sent armies to pacify Massachusetts, leading to the first battles of the Revolution. The ministry's escalation only deepened resistance. Across the colonies, revolutionary committees emerged, weakening and, in some places, chasing out royal authority. At a proto-national level, the Continental Congress formed in Philadelphia, creating a rival center of power that in 1775 deployed its own army with George Washington at its head. This was plainly illegal under the very British Constitution most colonists still profess to uphold. Yet, even amid war and the multiplication of extra-legal institutions, talk of independency largely remained private and tentative, imagined as a distant possibility rather than an immediate program. To be sure, some colonial leaders, among them Samuel and John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, and the young Thomas Jefferson, had come to favor a complete rupture. But the dominant view still held that Parliament and a corrupt ministry, not the king, bore responsibility for the crisis. Conciliationists such as John Dickinson and Joseph Galloway of Pennsylvania continued to hope for a settlement through some imperial reconfiguration, perhaps separate legislatures, under a shared monarchy. In fact, on the day common sense appeared, Dickinson's allies created a committee to reassure the inhabitants and the king that the Continental Congress was not seeking independence. This was true. Not a single colonial assembly had instructed its delegation at Philadelphia to consider independence. Monarchy itself had yet to be placed in the dock. Into this impasse, between a king waging war on his colonies and a political culture still reluctant to indict kingship itself, entered Tom Paine. He might have seemed like an unlikely candidate for the dramatic role he was about to take up. Paine had arrived in America only 14 months earlier, a letter of reference in hand from Franklin, whom he had met in London to discuss their shared interest in Newtonian physics. Then, utterly unknown in his native England, Paine, 39, quote, had failed at everything he had ever tried, end quote, writes historian Robert Middlecoff, as a corset maker, the trade he inherited from his father in Norfolk, as a schoolteacher, and as a petty bureaucrat. Disembarking in Philadelphia on November 30th, 1774, just as the First Continental Congress was retiring from the city, Paine found himself in exactly the right place at exactly the right moment. Philadelphia was then still the largest colonial city, though with only 30,000 inhabitants, just a large town by our standards. It was also the third busiest port in the British Empire, after London and Liverpool, and the most cosmopolitan place in America, with substantial numbers of immigrants from many parts of Europe and a large laboring population of artisans and common workers. Philadelphia was also home to the most radical politics. Paine situated himself in this milieu, befriending figures such as the scientist David Rittenhouse, the artist Charles Wilson Peel, and the physicians Thomas Young and Benjamin Rush, who treated the city's poor free of charge and advocated the new idea of administering inoculations against disease. It was Rush who suggested Paine take up his pen for independence. This proved a perspicacious choice. Common sense hit with meteoric force. The pamphlet, quote, bursts from the press, end quote, Rush wrote, quote, with an effect which has rarely been produced by types of papers in any age or country, end quote. Paine had, quote, put the torch to the combustibles, end quote, said Edmund Randolph of Virginia. The pamphlet was, quote, like a land flood that sweeps all before it, end quote, wrote a contemporary from Connecticut. Quote, we were blind, but the scales have fallen from our eyes, end quote. No part of the debate would ever be the same again. Common Sense sold 120,000 copies in its first 3 months and went through 25 separate editions in its first year. A comparable publishing run in America today would require some 15 million copies sold over a few months. But at that time, readership meant something more, reaching beyond those who were literate or who could purchase a book. One account from Philadelphia noted that the pamphlet was, quote, read to all ranks, end quote. It was discussed in public squares, in taverns, and in homes. Washington ordered passages of it, read to whole regiments of the Continental Army. Common Sense, in short, saturated the population with revolutionary ideas. Such a triumph cannot be located solely in Paine's prose. Franklin's much earlier success with the serialized Poor Richard's Almanac and his development of the colonial postal system helped create a shared print culture and the means to circulate it that made possible the vast debate among pamphleteers and editorialists, of which Common Sense was the crowning achievement. This print culture, in turn, had been prepared by incremental but decisive advances in printing and papermaking. The growth of cheap print markets, and expanding networks of newspapers, booksellers, and informal reprinting that allowed short, topical works to be produced rapidly and carried across the colonies. These developments now interacted with the transformations in consciousness produced by the imperial crisis itself, the changes, quote, in the minds of the people, end quote, as John Adams later put it. Paine's genius lay in giving this evolving sensibility compelling expression, articulating thoughts that, after years of crisis, were broadly shared. Quote, Time makes more converts than reason, end quote, he observed. History may have done the lion's share of the work, as Paine suggested, but it is not clear that any other figure could have done what he did. Little is known about his life in England, but his writing reveals an immersion in the 18th century Enlightenment world's, quote, Republic of Letters, end quote. It is just as certain that Paine had absorbed the underground radical traditions of the English Civil War, anti-monarchical, republican currents that survived Cromwell's defeat and continued to circulate, half-suppressed, in English political culture. On top of this, Paine's very failures in poverty contributed to his talent, suggests Bernard Balin. The pamphlet channeled, quote, the indignation and rage of the semi-dispossessed, living at the margins of respectable society and hanging precariously over the abyss of debtor prisons, threatened at every turn with an irrevocable descent into the hell that Hogarth painted so brilliantly and so compulsively in his savage morality tales. End quote. Whatever his own origins, there was something radically new about Paine's work. He wrote in an accessible way, designed not only to influence what would today be called, quote-unquote, opinion makers, but masses of colonists. Raised in and among England's despised, quote-unquote, lower orders, Paine knew his audience. He wrote in simple, direct, and vivid language, appealing to considerable knowledge of the Old Testament and the Book of Common Prayer. He eschewed Latin phrases and arcane references to the Roman Republic that had filled the pamphlets and newspaper columns of a decade of debate reaching back to Dickinson's highly influential Letters from a Pennsylvania Farmer, which had framed the crisis as one over representation and taxation. In this unadorned style, Paine stated what was. Reconciliation with the empire was no longer possible. Not the Parliament, not the ministry, not even King George as an individual was to blame. Tyranny and all the threats against the people emerged out of the system of monarchy and aristocracy, the very empire itself. Revolution, independence, with the goal of creating a republican government, was the only answer. Much of the pamphlet was devoted to a ferocious and often hilarious attack on monarchy and aristocracy. To appreciate its audience, contemporary readers must grasp that only a decade earlier, colonists bowed, scraped, and doffed their caps before even the lowest ranks of the British aristocracy represented in the colonies. Royal symbols were everywhere. The king's birthday was celebrated as a holiday. Monarchy aimed to overawe its subjects. And now Paine could state, with ruthless humor, that hereditary rule violated both reason and nature. Quote, one of the strongest natural proofs of the folly of hereditary right in kings is that nature disproves it, end quote, he wrote. Quote, otherwise, she would not so frequently turn it into ridicule by giving mankind an ass for a lion, end quote. Paine did not stint in laying out a reasoned case for his contempt for monarchy as a form of rule, writing, quote, there is something exceedingly ridiculous in the composition of monarchy. It first excludes a man from the means of information, yet empowers him to act in cases where the highest judgment is required. The state of a king shuts him from the world, yet the business of a king requires him to know it thoroughly. Wherefore the different parts, by unnaturally opposing and destroying each other, prove the whole character to be absurd and useless. End quote. This description of an increasingly complex society ruled over by entitled ignoramuses applies with even greater force to the America of Donald Trump, ruled by giant corporations with CEOs, paid many hundreds and even thousands of times the salary of the average workers, who collectively know the business far better. In Paine's view, the long history of feudalism offered no refuge, for the crowded heads of Europe. William the Conqueror, from whom all English monarchs were and are descended, was merely a, quote, French bastard landing with an armed banditti, end quote, a usurper who made himself king, quote, against the consent of the natives, end quote. Such ignominious origins spawned a corrupt political order in which centuries later George III, quote, hath little more to do than to make war and give away places, end quote, yet was rewarded extravagantly, quote, a pretty business indeed, end quote. Payne scoffed, quote, for a man to be allowed 800,000 sterling a year for, and worshipped into the bargain, end quote. Payne summed up his views of monarchy with stark calculus that does not have to be changed by one word after 250 years. Quote, of more worth is one honest man to society and in the sight of God than all the crowned ruffians that ever lived, end quote. But Payne's immediate target was not King George, but the suggestion, from temporizers such as Dickinson, that an understanding might yet be reached with the monarchy. Payne insisted that Lexington and Concord made conciliation as antiquated as, quote, the almanacs of last year, end quote. After the king's armies marched into the Massachusetts countryside and shed colonial blood, reconciliation became, in Payne's phrase, quote, a fallacious dream, end quote, for King George now revealed himself as a, quote, hardened, sullen-tempered pharaoh of England, a wretch that with the pretended title of father of his people can unfeelingly hear their slaughter and composedly sleep with their blood upon his soul, end quote. One cannot help but think, in reading this last line, of Donald Trump's embrace of the police murders of Alex Preddy and Renee Nicole Good in Minneapolis. From the blood spilled at Lexington and Concord, Payne turned outward. Britain's conduct, quote, declaring war against the natural rights of all mankind, end quote, thus elevated the conflict beyond a colonial dispute, transforming it into a struggle with universal human stakes. Quote, the cause of America, end quote, he proclaimed, quote, is in a great measure the cause of all mankind, end quote. Payne's pamphlet breathed a spirit of revolutionary optimism in its call for American independence from British rule. It told Americans they could take the step that they were on the brink of. Quote, we have it in our power, end quote, he assured. Quote, to begin the world anew, end quote. He explained that it was a moment that would be remembered for ages the world over. Quote, O ye that love mankind, ye that dare oppose not only the tyranny but the tyrant, stand forth. Every spot of the old world is overrun with oppression. Freedom hath been hunted round the globe. Asia and Africa have long expelled her. Europe regards her like a stranger, and England hath given her warning to depart. Oh, receive the fugitive, and prepare in time an asylum for mankind. End quote. America would serve, quote, the asylum for the persecuted lovers of civil and religious liberty, end quote, and, quote, a sanctuary to the persecuted in future years, when home should afford neither friendship nor safety, end quote. In Payne's vision, all those meeting in America were, quote, unquote, countrymen, and the new republic existed to welcome those fleeing oppression, lines that stand as a direct rebuke to Trump's language of, quote, unquote, invasion, quote, unquote, animals, and, quote, poisoning our country, end quote, when he speaks of immigrants and refugees. Payne's view of the struggle from a global standpoint was not unique in the revolutionary generation. The founding fathers, writes Gordon Wood, quote, never intended to make a national revolution in any modern sense, end quote. Summarizing Payne's views, the historian explains that, quote, the Americans were the most cosmopolitan people in the world. They regarded everyone from different nations as their countrymen and ignored neighborhoods, towns and countries as distinctions too limited for continental minds, end quote. The imagination of the Republican revolutionaries of the 1770s and 1780s, Paine foremost among them, may have been expansive, even universal, but it was not matched at that moment in history by the development of the world economy. The material foundations for a genuinely global fraternity did not yet exist. Production remained fragmented, communication slow, and social life overwhelmingly organized within imperial and emerging national capitalist frameworks that constrained even the boldest revolutionary aspirations. The present is different. Capitalism itself has created what earlier revolutionaries could only intuit: an integrated global economy and a working class whose labor, supply chains, and struggles cross every border. The idea of universal fraternity is no longer merely a moral appeal or philosophical hope. It is rooted in objective social relations. Workers today, for the first time in history, possess the material conditions that make Paine's promise concrete. They have it in their power, in a far more literal sense than Paine could have imagined, quote, to begin the world over again, end quote. The following is an appeal from WSWS Editorial Board Chairperson David North. It was published on the WSWS on January 21st.
I am appealing to you today to make as large a donation as you can to the World Socialist website New Year Fund. The first weeks of 2026 are a turning point in history. In Minneapolis, the power of the federal government is being deployed against the people. An ICE agent executed Renee Nicole Good at point-blank range, and the Trump administration has justified it. The city is under paramilitary occupation. Trump has threatened to invoke the Insurrection Act and has put the military on alert for deployment. Speaking to the billionaire oligarchs assembled in Davos, Trump declared that, quote, sometimes you need a dictator. The violent repression in Minneapolis is the implementation of Trump's plan to overthrow the Bill of Rights. What is happening in Minneapolis and other American cities is the domestic face of a government waging war on multiple fronts. On January 3rd, the administration launched an unprovoked invasion of Venezuela, killing civilians and abducting President Nicolas Maduro, in violation of all international law. Days later came threats to bomb Iran and reassertions of intent to annex Greenland by force. Threats are also being made against Canada. The violence abroad and repression at home flow from the same source, the crisis of American and world capitalism, and the staggering level of social inequality that prevails within this country and internationally. An Oxfam report this week found that in 2025, the net worth of U.S. billionaires surged 22% to a record $8.2 trillion. Elon Musk's wealth alone now exceeds $700 billion, far more than the GDP of most countries. This concentration of wealth in the hands of an oligarchy produces, inevitably, war abroad and dictatorship at home. The World Socialist website is unequaled in the depth and breadth of its coverage and analysis of events, which is rooted in Marxist theory and enriched by the vast experience of revolutionary struggles that span more than a century. From the invasion of Venezuela, the World Socialist website connected imperialist aggression to the logic of capitalism. When Renee Nicole Good was killed, the WSWS placed her murder in context, not as isolated violence, but as fascist policy. The World Socialist website does not merely report the news. It fights to develop the political leadership of the working class on a world scale. On December 12, 2025, the WS, and the International Committee of the Fourth International launched Socialism AI, a groundbreaking initiative arming workers and young people with the knowledge necessary to fight capitalism. The World Socialist website is utilizing this powerful technology in the interests of the working class, not for profit, but to provide access to Marxist theory, revolutionary history, and the program of the Trotskyist movement to millions of workers and young people throughout the world. As events move with extraordinary speed, Socialism AI makes accessible the accumulated knowledge of the revolutionary tradition to anyone seeking to understand and change the world. Moreover, it facilitates the organization of resistance of workers and young people to the attacks on their rights. The World Socialist website requires resources. Your donation goes directly toward daily coverage of critical events, socialist educational content, which is translated into multiple languages, and which plays an indispensable role in training a new generation of fighters for socialism. But while we need your financial support, we also urge you to become directly involved. Make your daily reading of the World Socialist website the basis of your direct participation in the fight for socialism. Use Socialism AI. Write to us. We will answer your inquiries. Attend meetings. Help build the International Workers' Alliance of rank-and-file committees in factories, workplaces, and neighborhoods to organize and unify the struggles of the working class. The crisis which is now unfolding will not be resolved by passive observation. It demands the conscious intervention of workers and young people prepared to act. This year marks the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. That declaration proclaimed the ideals of equality and the inalienable rights of man. The principles proclaimed in that revolutionary struggle now acquire renewed and urgent significance. Today it is the international working class that carries forward the struggle for human emancipation. The fight against imperialist war, against fascism, against the dictatorship of the capitalist oligarchy, is a world struggle of the working class for socialism. Join this fight. Take a stand against war, dictatorship, and inequality.